Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Just the Facts with me, Alex Zane, the podcast that takes a journey through the cinematic CV of a different guest every week to uncover some fascinating facts about their career. And thank you for being here for our thrill-filled 13th episode. Very quickly, if you haven't done so already, please right now hit the subscribe button on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts to get every single brand new episode delivered right to your device every Tuesday morning forever, forevermore. So as well as that, if you could take the time, if it allows you, on whatever podcast platform you use, to give us a little rating and a review, that is hugely appreciated too. For example, if you're on Apple Podcasts right now, you could think, I'm hearing this and I'll do it later. Don't do it later. Do it now. Just write a little review. A nice one, preferably, if you enjoy the show. That would be amazing and really useful for us. So thank you for that in advance. Don't forget, you can get all the latest news on our guests and updates about the show and what we're doing on our Twitter and Instagram, where we are at JTFpod. And if you prefer to watch your interviews rather than just listen to them or do both, then you can do that on our YouTube channel. Subscribe to Just the Facts with Alex Zane on YouTube. And the Friday after the pod comes out, you can watch the interview in full. Right then, my guest this week, a phenomenal actor who has season two of his very funny and surprisingly touching comedy series, The Excellent Code 404, coming out in just over a week on Sky, in which he stars alongside the brilliant Stephen Graham and Anna Maxwell Martin, and which I believe you can watch in the classic fashion, an episode each week for 6 weeks, or if it so pleases you, smash through the whole lot in one night. Just binge it, because all the episodes are available on Sky on September the 1st. So we talked a lot about that. We talked about him being nominated for a BAFTA. Anyone who saw season 3 of Line of Duty will know exactly what I'm talking about. He's incredible in it. He's not in it a lot, but boy, is he good. Got a BAFTA nomination for that. We talked about working on that. We talked about him having a cameo in Rogue One. We talked about him hanging off the awning of the Old Vic recently for a photo shoot. He is, in my opinion, one of our finest actors. It was a pleasure to have him on the show. So please welcome to Just the Facts, the bloody lovely Danny Mays.
Hello.
Yeah. You met Simon, didn't you? That's the last time we met.
I did. We were over in Highgate Woods, were we not?
That's right. Yeah, it was. I was trying to work it out because obviously we're going to talk about what you mentioned that day, code 404, in a second. But yeah, we were in Highgate Woods, and you were with Missy. It's Missy.
Missy,
right?
My toy Maltese, who's currently asleep right next to me on the sofa. If she wakes up and barks at the postman, that's who it is.
All right, that's good because Simon, my whippet, is everyone's left, so it's just me and thee in the house. But he's due his walk, so he's whining in the background. So apologies in advance if that happens.
Okay, he's dog apologies. Yeah, we were really toying, Alex, to getting a whippet. That was I love whippets, and somehow I got overruled by my wife and my daughter, so the women in the house, and we ended up getting a toy Maltese. But there you go.
But you're in love with Missy now, obviously.
We are in love with Missy, yeah. We wouldn't be. She's like, oh, her little eyes are perking up, going, oh, you're actually talking about me. Yeah. God, you spend like, you know, a day with your new dog and you just fall in love with them, don't you? So it's, yeah, it works.
It's crazy. Although when I met you, because it was, we were in lockdown, weren't we? We were still in.
We were in lockdown.
We were in lockdown, yeah. So I mean, it was like, what was it? Lockdown 3, 2, I can't remember, but yeah. I had that
2.0. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I got to the point where it stopped being a novelty at that point. Cause I like, it was great at the start walking around Highgate Woods, like walking the dogs. And then sort of as it went on, I was just like, this is,
I know now
I'm starting to live in a constant state of anxiety, which in this profession isn't uncommon anyway.
Like you took to it like a duck to water.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But no, it was lovely to see you in the woods. It's always nice. I'm not very, you know, that thing. I'm not very good. Like, cause most of the time I prepare to interview people. And then when you meet someone by chance, it's like, oh, bloody hell. Hello. How are you?
So what do we do now?
Yeah. Do I ask you a series of questions about your career? So, yeah.
So where did you train? Who are you co-starring with?
But you've just got back from holiday, haven't you? I mean, is it stalking? I mean, for an interviewer, Instagram is just a blessing because I know what you've been up to now.
Yeah, we just come back from Devon. I did do quite a lot of holiday posting, didn't I, on Instagram? I don't know what that is. I think that possibly is a consequence of lockdown and all of that. I don't know, we go to Solcombe every year. We went the year before last as well. And we just love it down there. And I just think, you know, it's great for the kids. There's so many activities. And also I've kind of got really friendly with a lot of the businesses down there, like the guy that does the fishing trips and the paddle boarding guy, Marcus. So I love them so much and they're lovely people. So I always like to give them a shout out on Instagram and give them a big up, you know?
Yeah. I saw the fishing trip as well. Big fish, big ling.
Oh my God. My son Milo caught a 15-pound, it's called a common ling. I mean, I'm not big really on my fishing. And this thing came out of the sea and I was like, what the hell is that? And he's like, it's a ling. I said, oh my God, never seen anything like it. So but actually my son's been offered a fishing job next year for 2 months down there with Squirrel, the fisherman, to be the assistant on the boat. So it looks like I'll be going back down there again. I'm like, I want to go to Ibiza. I don't want to keep going to Devon. You know what I mean?
And you've got your sea legs then, so you don't get seasick. I mean, because I've only been sea fishing on a boat once off Newquay about 2007. And the only fish that I saw came out of my mouth. Back into the sea, which was that. It's a weird thing to do anyway. So I'm about to go fishing, so I'll probably eat fish and chips, and then.
Yeah. Oh, do you know what, Alex? It doesn't affect me. I've actually shot twice on like. I remember doing a Treasure Island for Sky. Eddie Izzard was Long John Silver.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And it was like we were out filming it in Dublin and we were on the big ship. And it was like they said, listen, some of you, if you're prone to getting seasickness, we can give you these tablets. And some actors took them, some actors didn't, but it really affected people, each individual at different times. So you would be completely spaced out doing a scene with someone and they'd just feel like completely woozy. And the other instance was when we made Fisherman's Friends, and that was a particularly rocky sea. And I will never, ever forget the focus puller on that job. You know, when someone says, you've turned green. I now know what that means. I've seen that close up. And I don't know whether it was because that was his job and he had to, you know, make sure it was in focus and he was looking at the horizon or whatever it was. But all of a sudden, he just turned and the whole colour drained from his face. And he spewed and the wind caught it and it just flew straight back in his face. I was like, oh, man, let's get off this boat as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I appreciate his predicament. That was me, and it just came at the worst time as well. So we were sharing the boat with these proper fishermen, like who they'd been out already in the morning, and they'd come back to pick us up. And I was at the height of my like wanky indie phase, where I was in skinny jeans, vest top, a trilby, and I got on this boat, and they sort of looked at me, and I was like, I can pull this off. You just wait, boys, and then. Within 10 minutes, I'm spewing my guts up over the side. And they were just looking at me. It was like, they were proper like Quint types, like, those are city hands, boy. Been counting money all your life.
Yeah. So, yeah. Scars, tattoos everywhere. Yeah.
The works. Yeah. I'll never put on a life jacket again. That shit. So, yeah, it is, when this goes out, 1 week until season 2 of Code 404. Comes out on Sky, which is exciting for me, I'm assuming for you.
Yeah, we're all buzzing about it. I mean, Alex, I've only saw the whole completed 6 episodes last weekend. We had an amazing cast and crew. That was the other thing. When the first series came out, that was in lockdown, and none of us have really been able to get into a room and celebrate the success of the first series. Mm. So we had a great cast and crew on Saturday. And it's just, I mean, I'm calling it an upgrade. You know what I mean? It feels a lot more confident. It's bigger. It's bolder. All those things that you want a second series to be. But the fact that we did shoot this in lockdown, Code 404 season 2 was one of the first shows to come back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I hadn't worked for 7 months. It was quite a rarity for me, actually, because I'm always quite busy. So
how was that then, like going from, because you are really busy and it just seems to be getting busier and busier, but to go from literally that busy, because that's how I felt, like I was saying, that sort of it was a real shock to the system, and it went from this is nice to then this is not so nice. But I did enjoy it at the start, that rarity of like having nothing.
Well, I was Milo, what was he then, 14, and Dixie must have been 7, so it was homeschooling, all that stuff. And then I had this tragic accident with my wife where she literally broke her leg.
Oh, geez.
The Sunday before the schools were shut down. She had a freak accident on a dog walk and slipped and broke her leg. So my wife was in bed. Dixie, our daughter, was homeschooling. And our son Milo was doing his mock exams I felt like Michael Keaton in Mr. Mum. I didn't know what was going on. So I didn't really have time to think, going, oh my God, where's my next job coming from? I was just taking each day as it comes. But so 404 was the first back. And I remember Stephen Graham, who co-lead in it with me, who plays Roy Carver, he phones me and says, man, I just like, it feels like the first job we've ever done. You're like, how do we do? We were both quite nervous. But you get into the swing of it. But it was a kind of different playing field that first couple of weeks, because it was PCR tests and social distancing and all that kind of, all of the crew wearing masks. So, but the biggest compliment I can give the second series is that, you know, you don't see any of that on screen. That was the biggest concern, is that somehow we were going to cut corners shooting in a pandemic, and nothing could be further from the truth. So it's great. It's a lot. It's a sort of darker story. It's still laugh out loud funny, but it seems to be a lot more emotional, actually, particularly the last 3 where it goes. So I love Code 404 because there's so many different elements to it. And I think fans of the first series are going to have an absolute ball with it second time round.
It's interesting you talk about it being shot in COVID, because obviously it's a comedy series. I mean, I call it a comedy, and you touched on it there, and we can talk about that, because it does do that amazing thing of manage to balance comedy with drama and actual emotional stakes. And then
yes,
it looks like a freaking cool crime series. The way it's shot is beautiful. It is.
Yes, so, yes.
So it's got all those things, but ultimately is a comedy. And I've always imagined, like, on the set of a comedy, the atmosphere on set is kind of conducive to how good the series is. Now, I might be wrong, but I imagine that you want to have fun. You want to, you know, the crew to be having fun, and you want that kind of atmosphere of enjoyment. And I just wonder whether that was kind of a difficult thing to achieve when everyone's like, okay, action.
It was, because, you know what it's like when you're shooting a show and everyone's wearing masks, that whole thing of you not seeing their mouths, or you know what I mean, seeing people smile, and the sense of communication through lip reading or actually looking at a person's mouth move is integral. Do you know what I mean? So it was kind of strange. It probably, but I guess it was down to me and Stephen and all the other actors to sort of, you know, galvanize everyone and keep that energy up. Because I mean, Code 404 is a really fun show to watch, but it's a kind of to act it is relentless 6 weeks work, because we're kind of pretty much in every scene, and we always get halfway through it and we go, bloody hell, this is a killer, isn't it? But comedy. It's meant to be easier.
I imagine, yeah, for you as well, because it is, it's a big performance, you know, your character, yeah, because there's a lot of physicality involved, because for anyone who hasn't seen the series, you are a cybernetic organ, part human, 90% human, 10% cybernetic organism. Brought
That's
back
a good description, death. Alex. Yeah.
Thanks very much. I like my sci-fi. I imagine it must be, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I guess one of the reasons you wanted to play the role is because it's a real carte blanche. It's like, you know, you can do anything with that, because no one can ever go, oh, no, Danny, that is not how you play a resurrected cop who's now part robot. That's just not it.
Exactly. You can kind of have, it's a gift, Alex, really. I mean, as soon as I read the, like, we shot a pilot, and I mean, look, I got a call from my agent, and she was like, they want to attach you to this comedy, and he gets killed in the first episode. And I was like, hold on a minute, I think we've ticked that box, haven't we? And she went, no, he comes back part man, part AI. And I was like, wow, that sounds completely mad. And I read it, but it's Daniel Peake, our writer. He's an extraordinary talent, and it was kind of gag after gag on each page. And I always remember my wife was in the kitchen and I was laughing out loud, and she was like, so you're going to do it then? And I was like, without a doubt, as soon as I had that guttural reaction to it. And it's just a joy to play, because like you say, it is physical. There's emotion in it. It's slapstick. I mean, I always describe it as like a cross between RoboCop and Some Mothers Do Have Them. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of that. It's sort of a blend of those two shows. Oh. But I love the poignancy we get in it. I love the drama. And I, you know, we're blessed to have amazing actors in it, like the likes of Stephen Graham and Anna Maxwell Martin, Rosie Cavaliero, who are equally as comfortable in comedy as they are in serious drama. And I think that's to Code 404's credit and its strength, you know, and it's a joy to play in both those tones with it.
Yeah. And like I said, it looked cool. Do you know, it's weird. I was, it reminds me, and completely by chance, I'd love this to be a wonderful segue, but it's not, completely by chance. One of the movies that I think has made London look as cool as Code 404 does is a film that you were actually in, which I was on the set of Welcome to the Punch, Erin Creevy's film.
And yes, you're on, yeah.
I've never seen London look as cool as it does in that movie. I mean, obviously you were in Shifty before that, that yes, you directed, but that's a cool looking movie.
Yeah, Rani is an amazing talent, because we made that independent film Shifty, which really punched above its weight. And the great thing about Erin Creevy as a filmmaker is that He didn't want his next movie to be a carbon copy of what had been before. Like, he wants to jump around in different genres and types of films. And he was always really taken with, you know, Japanese action films and John Woo and all that sort of stuff. So I think the way that they shot that film, it was, London had never been seen like that on screen before. And in actual fact, there are, yeah, absolute comparisons to Code 404. Mm. That, I mean, I know that Al Campbell, our director of Code 404, goes up in the helicopter at the end of the shoot and has a day just sort of shooting the landscape. And it's brilliant because the whole thing just opens up. And yeah, we've got an amazing set piece and stunt sequence at the end of the series in Docklands with the helicopter and everything. So, I mean, that was another thing to try and be, as I said, bigger and bolder with all of the stunts. Yeah, but I love Welcome to the Punch. I think it's a really underrated movie, actually.
It is underrated, and it's a shame it didn't do better, because I really enjoyed it, and I like being on the set of that movie as well. So, yeah, no, it was good. So you mentioned some others do have, and comedy. And I will say, just, you know, we're sitting here talking about Code 404, and there is a real hunger for this second season. We're not just talking about it in a sort of abstract fashion, because, like, the first season was huge for Sky. I think it's like one of the most binged series, or the quickest binge series ever for a Sky original comedy, or some crazy stat like that.
Yeah, like it was like their most watched show in 8 years or something, yeah, like that. I mean, I tweeted that out. I was like, yeah, go on, blow your own trumpet.
You know, you got it.
It's great. It's, yeah, you go. You know, it's, I mean, my phone didn't stop pinging when the first series came out, you know, so it was, it's got a core fan base now. And I'm just excited to get that second season out and show them what we've got.
And it's great watching you and Stephen on screen together. I really enjoy watching the double act that you've got going. And you mentioned this, and he was quite honest in an interview. He said that, you know, as you started filming the first season, he did feel a little bit like, I'm not sure, Danny, I'm not sure if I've got my head in this yet. I don't know if I'm playing this right.
Yeah, he did say that to me, and I was sort of somewhat taken aback, because I mean, I think the thing about Major and Carver is they are literally just a classic comedic double act, you know, straight man, funny man. And I think that's, you know, through generations of comedy, isn't it? Like, that sort of gimmick has sort of, the rewards of that have been tenfold, you know. So, and I just said to him, you know, just do what you do. I think just play it straight. And particularly with the second season, he really, I think without Stephen in it, because he's so truthful, he's so grounded and believable in what he does, that it does, he is without question the emotional heartbeat of it, you know. And again, we kind of investigate that whole love triangle thing that was going on in the first season. So all of that's still in there, all that sort of subtext of betrayal and all that jealousy that they've got of one another. So, but I just said, Steve, just be you, play it down, just play it truthfully, and then I'll just jump around and act like a loon. And somehow, hopefully, it works.
And it's not your first sitcom rodeo together either. And I remember this clearly, because I was actually working at MTV in 2004. I was a VJ, as we used to be called. And it was a big thing that MTV had made this show, because I think, and I might be incorrect, but I think it was the first sitcom MTV had ever done. Yeah. And that was the Johnny Vaughan written Top Buzzer, which was you and Stephen. And I remember that being on MTV.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. I mean, God, that's going back, I don't know what, 16, 17 years or 17 something like years. That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Written by Johnny Vaughan, the brilliant Ed Allen. It was just an absolute, that was the first time I met Steve. So we got on like an absolute house on fire. And that was the job that I met my wife on, Lou. And Steve played Cilla Black. He's our Cilla Black. He was a complete matchmaker, because I was frightened about asking her out, and he sort of did it for me. And anyway, the 2.4 children and a toy Maltese dog later, here we are. It's all his fault. It was just a crazy time, that Top Buzzer. It was, I mean, we used to shoot, you know, 10 pages a day. We were down there in Three Mill Studios, and every day you'd be like, it was like a shooting a short film when you got the sides. I'm like, how on earth are we going to get through this? But the brilliant James Lance and Perry Benson and all these brilliant actors and but it's got a real cult following that, hasn't it?
Oh, it does.
I still get little stoners coming up to me now and again going, are you going to do a second series of Top Buzzer? I was like, 17 years ago, I don't think so. If they were going to do it, it would have been made already.
Yeah, you smoke that much weed, I think time and your perception of time changes. It probably feels like yesterday to them. It just finished last night, man. I was just watching it last night. Surely the second series is due any day now.
Yeah, no, we've all moved on. Yeah.
And your first ever credit, I feel like I'm going really back in time now, but it's only because it's a show that I was a huge fan of at the time. Your first screen credit is in the Stuart Lee, Richard Herring show, Fist of Fun.
Oh, wow. Yes. Yeah. I was in that classroom scene, wasn't I?
That's yeah, right. Yeah. The teacher scene. Yeah.
Kelly Brook was in that as well. I mean, I was at stage school then. I was at Italia Conti, and it was one of those random castings that you just got. And but wow, what amazing comedians to start off with, you know. It's not a bad first credit, is it?
Not a bad first credit at all. But you would have been about 17 then, and like you just said, you've been studying acting for a while. So at what point did you realize that you wanted to act and actually pursue this career like properly, like that was what you wanted to do?
I guess it must have been around that time when I was about, you know, 15, 16, where I was always performing. I was always jumping around doing impressions and doing Michael Jackson routines. And that's the thing that led me to stage school. But then when I got to about 15, 16, you're maturing, and then you start looking. I mean, it was all those independent American movies and the actors like the De Niro's and the Pacino's and Gene Hackman, all those sort of, you know, incredible 70s and early 80s American movies that you just, that's when I knew, you know. And it wasn't just actors like that. It was homegrown talent, like, you know, Gary Oldman and you just wanted to be seen as a serious actor. And I think that's when a shift happened in me. And I then went from stage school on to RADA. So I actually had quite a lot of training. Really, yeah. But they were sort of poles apart, really. You know, going from a stage school to RADA was kind of, it took some adjusting to, if that makes sense. Because, you know, RADA was from the inside out. It was Stanislavski. It was all sort of internalizing a character, whereas Italia Conti was all tits and teeth. with all due respect to Conti's, but it wasn't where I was at anymore. So, I wanted to get all serious on it, yeah.
So there wasn't one moment, one film, seeing one actor, seeing someone on stage. There was never a single defining thing that made you go, holy shit, that's
well,
it.
I was always a keen artist. I'd say what I used to do, like when I was doing my GCSE art, so I used to paint on the dining room table at home. And I always remember... it was on Channel 4, they had a retrospective of De Niro's films. I never forget it. And it was like, every time it went to the commercial break, there was this bronze bust of his head. And I would sort of paint, and I would always have the television on. And it was like every Sunday night, quite late at 10 o'clock or whatever it was. And they started every week, there was a new De Niro film. And I must have just stopped painting, and then I just started watching it, because like one week it was Raging Bull, then it was Taxi Driver, and then it was King of Comedy. And you were like, and I, it sort of kind of shook me to my core that this one guy was week after week performing these diverse and completely extraordinary characters. And so that whole mystique of, you know, being versatile, of stretching yourself and using a different part of yourself to play a character is that kind of blew my mind. So it was pretty much that the work of De Niro that really, really kind of inspired me, I'd say.
Well, it's interesting, because I think, you know, the same could be said of you in terms of the kind of roles that you pick and the way that you sort of disappear into the characters and how diverse they are. I mean, you sort of look at prior to lockdown, I mean, we talked about how busy you were. But you look at how different they are. There's Code 404, there's Temple, there's White Lines on Netflix, Good Omens, films like Fisherman's Friends. And that's a very eclectic mix of characters and tones of series.
Yeah, and it's not really been a conscious choice, really. I mean, I've never really been one of those actors that has had a sort of, you know, game plan as such. I always had that sense of wiping the slate clean with every new job, and that age-old sort of adage of you're only as good as your last job. I kind of really believe in that, but I did have a lot of training, like I said, so I did, as much as I was sort of ridiculing stage school, maybe that sort of training of you know, musical theatre and things like that, mixed in with a sort of classical training from RADA, I felt sort of comfortable in both those worlds. And I think, I mean, look, I guess I equally love doing comedy as much as the serious stuff. But for your own sense of being, you, as a performer, you want to keep mixing it up. You never really want to perform the same thing over and over, because it becomes law of diminishing values, isn't it? And it's or a sort of variation on a theme. And I think, you know, I mean, I do see actors that sort of do that, and I've worked with them, and you think, come on, there's more in the locker than that. You know, you've got to find those roles that really frighten you, that really go. I mean, I remember doing it was repeated this week, this single drama, Against the Law, for BBC Two, which was the biopic of Peter Wildblood, a journalist in the 50s that got imprisoned for being homosexual. And it was like, never in a million years would I be imagined that I would be offered a role like that. And I very nearly turned it down because of the intimacy of the scenes. I didn't know if I was up to that. And so it was petrifying in many regards, but my God, it was probably the most rewarding, exhilarating experience I've ever been involved in. And I'm so pleased I felt the fear and did it, because I sort of surprised myself. And I think that's really where you want to be. It's very difficult when you leave drama school or you first get in the industry, you've got your head above the parapet and you just want to get your foot in the door. I completely get that. But the longer you stay in the game and the more people you work with and the relationships that you forge, it's then that you can really start to stretch yourself, and people would say, man, well, let's try this, you know, or let's go in this different direction. And that's the sweet spot. That's where you really want to get, and you have to embrace that and try something else.
Well, I don't know if this next role that I want to talk to you about scared you. It certainly falls more on the serious side. And it'd be interesting if it scared you when you read it. But your performance in season 3 of Line of Duty, it's a hell of a performance, a hell of an opening episode. Sadly, your only episode in the series. And when you got that script, I mean, you know, I don't want to jump the gun, but obviously you got the BAFTA nomination for that performance. Yeah. So this isn't just me saying how great it is. This is bloody BAFTA. But did you read that on the page and go, this is special and potentially scary?
I knew it was special. I knew, I was a huge fan of the first two series, so I was already really sort of tempted by it. And then I loved the show, and you go, right, they want to audition you for the new lead, and you're like, okay, this already feels big. But then I read the first ep, and it was from the off, it was just next level, you know. I mean, he's an armed response officer and he guns down a suspect within the first couple of pages. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, you don't see that every day. And then before you know it, you're into this huge interrogation scene, which was pretty much like 15 pages long. Mm. And he could speak chapter and verse, couldn't he, about how a bullet flies through the air. And you were like, it was sort of Shakespearean in the speeches that he was coming out with. It was sort of, in terms of the dialogue learn, it was kind of extraordinary and very challenging and difficult and all those things. But by the end of it, this kind of, on the surface of things, this psychopath who guns people down and does terrible things, you reveal that he's suffering from all this child abuse and trauma, and you suddenly go, wow, that is an absolute box of tricks just waiting to be opened. And then the rug's pulled right at the very end as well. So in terms of, like, I remember going into the audition and there was the director there and Jed Mercurio, and the first thing I said was like, does he make it? Like, what's going on here? And they went, listen, sadly, this is the we're going to pull the rug and kill off the new lead. And I was like, wow. So, but the remit for the audition, Alex, was to learn as much as you could of that interrogation scene. And I had about a week with it, and I pretty much learned the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? That's how much I really wanted it. If not the whole thing, then a good sort of 10 pages of it. I was like, you need to get this. It was one of those, without sounding too arrogant or anything like that, it was one of those opportunities where you go, it was one of those meetings where you just say, leave it all in the room. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I do.
Whatever you do, Danny, don't leave this room now and regret that you didn't try that or you didn't go for it. Give it double barrels. And I think I was so gung-ho about getting that job that I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And luckily it came my way. And I know that they saw some great actors for it as well, but it was, it's always the most, the most amazing part of my job is when you do, the feeling you get when you really want a casting and you really want a role and it lands in your lap and you get it. That sort of feeling of achievement is priceless, you know. Mm. And you have to remember that, and then you have to sort of take that on board and go, shit, I've got to now actually go on and do it. But I think when you have that desire to play something, it kind of fuels the duration of the shoot. And I'm blown away by Line of Duty now. It kind of, Series 3 did so well, and it went on to BBC One. It's now this huge, huge show for the BBC.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com Acast.com/host.
And I'm just very honoured and proud to be part of it all. You know, it was, I have to say, it was an intense 2-week shoot, but adored every second with Martin and Adrian and Vicky. And Jed Mercurio is a genius. You know, he's that show that he's created is stellar. You know what I mean? It's meticulously researched and he knows the material inside and out. And I'm just so, I'm thrilled for him, really. He's a lovely guy.
And I mean, you know, that interrogation scene, like on the page, it's a man reciting the codes of the police force. And yet, you know, to actually watch it, it says so much about the character. That's for me, that's what I took from it. Like what, understanding like the writing, which on the page is one thing. And then combined with your performance, it's just like, it's such a telling scene. Like you learn so much about your character without him saying fucking anything about who he is.
There's a lovely moment towards the very end where, I mean, it's an interrogation, isn't it? So they're trying to chink at his armor and he's kind of like this, he's a bit John Major, and he's a bit robotic. He's not crumbling anyways. And it's when they question his sexuality that it's suddenly there's a shift and you go, wow. And I remember reading that thinking, wow, that's just brilliant writing. It's such a huge reveal. And it's always in those moments of any character you play, if you can just, you know, reveal the inner life of a character, it's always the most interesting. I think that was what was so great about Danny Waldron. He was a conundrum. You couldn't really ever work him out. There was always that sort of mystique to him, which was sort of enticing to watch.
And they do.
I'd absolutely enjoy it. It was a massive turning. It was a huge turning point, I think, in my career. You know what I mean? It sort of, as you mentioned, there was a BAFTA nomination, and it just did me all the world of good to be part of it. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, do you feel like, because there was the BAFTA nomination, there was the fact the series did so well, there were the plaudits for your performance in that episode. Did you feel a real sea change in terms of to actually qualify the kind of roles that were coming through, or the scale of the roles, or a change in the kind of phone calls that were coming in?
I think it's a lot of the time, you know, there's so many great actors out there, but you know, you're always playing around with that idea of, is someone bums on seats? Are they commercially valuable or not? Do you know what I mean? And that's a horrible way of looking at it, but from a business point of view, you know, we see it in films, isn't it? It takes a certain actor to green light a project, and that's just the reality of the business. And I think certainly after Line of Duty, even though I was killed after one episode, it was clear that, you know, I had the capacity to sort of lead a show. And I think because that is a huge responsibility when you're the lead of the show, because it does start at the top. How you dictate yourself, how you behave on set, how you carry yourself, how much work you put in, I think all of that filters down to the actors beneath you, you know. And I think by no stretch of the imagination am I a diva or anything like that. I just don't think there's any place in the industry for things like that. It's always about the graft, you know. It's about it's about the work and enjoying the work and leaving it in the room. I think that's the ethos of how I go about things.
I guess it must, being offered leads and like you say, it's sort of a lot of it is on you as the lead in a series. I imagine the pressure increases though, because like you say, it's bums on seats. It's how many people are going to watch this series. And if you've gone, if you're looking at something and going, all right, I'm the lead in this, I've been off the lead in this, you're also then for the first time really having to consider the quality of the series, the writing, the what it is and whether people are actually going to watch it, because, you know, they will go, you know, Danny May's new series hasn't done so well in the ratings, as opposed to if you were a supporting player in it, it would be someone else, or it would be the series. It wouldn't come back to you. So you must have to be a little more delicate with what you actually say yes to.
I think so. I think, I guess the next step, and lots of contemporaries of mine are starting to form their own production companies. So maybe that pressure's taken off of them. And well, hold on, I am the boss. So it's like, what's the issue? But maybe that's the next. I mean, I've been talking, you know, to people about trying to create your own work. And I mean, you know, Code 404 was a prime example of them coming to me and then wanting to attach me to get the green light and to get the thing off the ground. And that was incredibly flattering. But it's about, you know, now I think trying to think about the characters I really want to play and talking to the right people and creating your own work. You know, it's that's sort of really interesting to me. But the thing of you know, you getting the green light on something, it's always, I mean, I recently did I love doing it, the Dennis Nilsson drama for ITV. And, you know, I mean, you know, David Tennant was obviously the guy that greenlit that project, and rightly so, because he's absolutely phenomenal. So I think once you get, you know, once they get their name like that, then I think, you know, I knew that Lewis Arnold, the director, had carte blanche as to who he would pick for the two other roles. And it was myself and the brilliant Jason Watkins. So that sort of sense of business and how big you are in the ratings, that never really goes away. You have to just learn to live with that. I mean, I still miss out on stuff, Alex. You know what I mean? I'm still, in a weird sort of way, the more successful you get, I don't know if you find this in your side of things, but it's you know, the more traction you get, the higher up the ladder you go, then you're coming into contact with some serious talent. Yeah. And it's like, well, hold on a minute. And they go, what do you mean I haven't got it? Who's got it? And it's such and such. And you go, oh yeah, well yeah, they are pretty good, aren't they? But, I mean, that's just par for the course, you know. And I guess I've got better at sort of coping with all that, you know. Rejection is the name of the game, actually, at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's how you process that, and it's a very strange thing. I think you can live a long time in an industry and like you'd assume that rejection has just become par for the course and it's water off a duck's back, and you can never separate out the personal from like the business. You're like, it feels like it's about me. It's about something, my craft, what I do, what I bring. And it's not just they've found someone better. It's because they don't like me.
Exactly. I'm not selling insurance or Hoovers, for example. It's like, it's me. What is about me you don't like? But, you know, it is what it is.
There was on this subject of sort of like contemporaries and other, I mean, he's a great actor, Eddie Marzan, who I'm a huge fan of, who you've obviously worked with a couple of times, Red Riding, the Limehouse Golem, And he put a tweet out recently, which I thought was really interesting. And it was off the back. Let's actually talk about what it was off the back of before. It was your ES magazine interview, the Evening Standard magazine. That photo on that cover, and maybe I love it the most because I saw the video that went with it, because it's a nuts photo. Just for people who haven't seen it, what is that photo and was it planned? Because it looks terrifyingly impromptu.
I recently performed the Dumb Waiter at the Old Vic with a massive acting hero of mine, David Thewlis. We had a great, short, sharp, brilliant run of the Dumb Waiter, and it just came in with my publicist, and they said, "Look, they want to put you on to celebrate the opening of theatre and all the rest of it. They want to do a cover piece on the Evening Standard magazine." I said, "That's amazing." I said, "But what they really want is to shoot in the theatre itself, you know, in that beautiful auditorium there and on the main stage." And they were umming and ahhing whether they were going to allow it, and then they did. And so we had all the stylists and all everything and different outfits and makeup, costume, boom, main stage, auditorium, blah, blah, blah. And they said, what would be great, because at the front of the building at that time, it said, because it was the Old Vic Back Together season, and they had emblazoned on the sign at the front, Back Together, in big red flashing lights. And it was like, great. I mean, it would be great, wouldn't it, if we could get you out on the roof, and then health and safety started going, this is terrible, we can't be doing this. Anyway, it looked pretty safe. It was fine. You know what I mean? And I was like, let's just do it. And they grabbed the ladder and went over the other side of the street. And But I have to say, when I got actually out onto the ledge, it did look a little bit unsteady under the foot. So I was, and they were going, put both feet on it. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be doing that because it was ridiculously high up.
Uh-huh.
And I had the flashing back together sign. I was either going to get electrocuted by the sign or I was going to plummet to my death. But we managed to get the shot. But the funny thing about it, on that day, it was when England played Germany in the Euros. Mm. And so when I was out there, all these drunk English fans like were going, yeah, oh, look, it's Danny Dyer. It's Danny Dyer. And I was like, oh, whatever, I'll just go with it. And we started singing Football's Coming Home. So it was without doubt the most memorable photo shoot I've ever done. It was brilliant. And produced an amazing front cover, I have to say.
It's honestly, I think it's one of those photos that is very iconic. It looks great. It's celebrating the reopening of theatre and it looks genuinely like a health and safety nightmare.
Yeah, it definitely was that.
It's got all this. I once had a photo taken. This sounds like a name drop. It's not, but I was on the top of the IMAX doing a Mission Impossible premiere. And I was doing a photo with Tom Cruise on this gantry like that extends out over the street. And again, health and safety were like, we don't recommend going on it. And if you do, you've got to be attached to these wires because no one's been on that gantry for about 10 years. And I'm like, all right. So I'm standing there waiting and he bounds out like Tom Cruise and it's like, hey, hey. And the guy's like, so you need to wear this. He's like, no, I don't. And gets out on this gantry. No wire. And he's like, this is exciting, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, but, and then he starts shaking the whole thing side to side. Because he's a stuntman. And he's like, I'm standing there watching plumes of rust like explode from these bolts that haven't had any stress put on them in 10 years. And I'm standing there thinking, if this goes and me and Tom Cruise fall to our deaths, tomorrow morning, no one's going to know I've died because that'll be it. That'll be the story. But it's health and safety are funny because just to watch the guy turn around and go to the photographer, I am no longer responsible for this and walk off. You're like, where are you going?
Yeah. No, come back.
It's terrifying. But yeah, great photo. So what I was going to say about Eddie Marzan, it was a lovely tweet. He said that he called you a shining example to those from a less privileged background. Which is raising that point, I think has been discussed like over the years about acting still being somewhat of an exclusive club. To enter acting, you know, it's not easy. It's, you know, there you need to have a bit of money behind you, maybe contacts, networking. And it does seem like certain people have it easier to access acting and make a career of it. Do you think that is starting to change now here in 2021? Do you think people from less privileged backgrounds are being able to get into the career of acting and explore that easier?
I think there has been a shift over recent years. I think when I think about the likes of, you know, Daniel Kaluuya or Riz Ahmed, or I think, you know, they're really breaking through. I remember doing an initiative a couple of years ago for RADA, and they came to me and they said, you know, it was their goal to try and hunt out and find, you know, poorer kids from lesser backgrounds. So I know drama schools like that have initiatives, but it's, and I think maybe what Eddie was going on about is that maybe so much working class actors aren't celebrated as much as other people or stuff like that. And I think there is an argument to that, you know, and I think the likes of the Eddies and the, Stephen Graham's and the Johnny Harris's aren't as celebrated as maybe our sort of posher contemporaries. I mean, I'm not taking away from those guys. They're incredible. But I think there's always room for the door to always be open and to always spread the net as far and wide as you can to find, you know, kids from poor backgrounds, because you need that. You need the thing is, and it's not just actors, it's people, it's writers, it's the producers, it's the next generation of directors. It's on both sides of the camera, because and there then you can really tell those working class stories. And I think if you never want to get into a place where those types of films are never being made. I mean, I sat down when we're down in Devon, we sat down and watched Kez. I showed my the son that because we went to a falconry and he was like obsessed with kestrels. And I went, oh my God, we've got to put Kez on. And I'd not seen it in years.
Is he all right? If I remember it rightly, that doesn't end well.
My God. It's the most depressing end. Mm. I mean, you know, his elder brother, right, kills the kestrel and that's it. And he buries it and it ends. That's the end of the movie.
Yeah. I think I might have watched that. And what was it? The Ring of Bright Water, the one with Tarka the Otter in. I couldn't believe it. I think I watched Kez about a week earlier and then I watched that and I'm like, the fucking otter dies at the end. He gets killed by his love. He loves this otter and the dogs kill it. I'm like, what is it with British movies? Where's the Goonies? Give me the Goonies. I'll put the Goonies
get on. But the authenticity in that, in the films of Ken Loach and people like Mike Lee, I've done work with Mike, you know, they're the types of films, those sort of ordinary working class stories, they always need to have a voice and a place and a platform. To balance it up, you can have Marvel films, you can have all the rest of it and musicals or whatever it is, but you still need to have those working class voices coming through. And I think actors, directors, all of us, we need to keep fighting that fight. Yeah.
I think there's some real truth in this idea of working class actors, and I guess this is a
says the man who's about to play a robot next. Yeah,
and it is like, because I'm from a working class background up in Leeds, and it feels like a delicate conversation to have purely because you don't want to be doing that working class hero shtick, which is like you don't want to be like to go back to Quint again from Jaws, because seemingly that's every reference point. City hands, Mr. Hooper, you've been counting money all your life. It's like you don't want to be that guy. But at the same time, you sort of say, Stephen Graham, Eddie Marzan, and Vicky McClure. These are the names that underneath Eddie's tweet, it was like the same sort of three names kept coming up. Like those were just the only other three people aside from yourself who people could name, who potentially could fit into that category of and so when you're seeing those same names repeated over and over, you're like, well, bloody hell, that's all anyone knows.
I know. I remember reading a great piece in The Guardian a few years back saying, where is the next Gary Oldman? You know what I mean? I mean, he was always an actor now that I greatly admire, but I tell you what the weird thing is, Alex, it's taken me, I've been acting for 20 years, but there's been a couple of occasions where, for example, someone wanted to cast me in an upper class role. And it was I remember the casting director saying, it was a pilot for an AMC show. And there was two roles, two brothers separated at birth. One was an Essex boy and one was a gentrified surgeon in 18th century London, and it was written by Rowan Jones, this brilliant American guy, and I obviously went in for the Cockney role, didn't I? And he was like, "Well, hold on, can't we, Danny's great, can't we, let's test Danny for the other brother?" And it was like the room was like, "Oh no, we don't do that. Danny doesn't do that." And he was like, "What do you mean?" And he went, "We don't do that with Danny." And he was like, "What? What do you mean?" And it was, in the end, I ended up screen testing for both the roles, and I got the posh one, and the brilliant Tom Hollander. So our social class was switched in those two roles. It never got picked up. I've seen it. It was great, but it took an American's sensibility to sort of look at that and go, "Hold on, why can't we do that? Let's just play it outside the box." And sometimes we get so blinkered in this country. Do you know what I mean? And I'm talking to casting directors when I'm saying this, is that, try and be as creative and inventive with your choices as possible. Because there are kids from poorer backgrounds who have a huge capacity for playing a whole wide breadth of characters. And they just need to be given the chance. Do you know what I mean? And it's, I've had to really fight for that. Throughout my career, and I mean, hopefully, you know, I'll continue to do so, and it won't be so difficult.
And do you think maybe for you it is going to be a series that is transatlantic, an American series with American creators? Is that something that you'd like to do in terms of being able to, like you say, with that example, perhaps be in a position to explore roles that you wouldn't necessarily be handed here?
Yeah, I think so. That's definitely something that hasn't sort of come to fruition yet. The whole big American series that, you know, contemporaries of mine, friends of mine that have gone over there and really smashed it. I'm not going to lie. That is definitely something I'm really keen on doing. It feels like it's something I haven't properly explored. And if by doing that, it opens up a whole different array of characters for me and I'm successful with it, then that would be fantastic. You know what I mean? But I mean, you never want to go over to the States, for example, and do terrible work. You know what I mean? I don't want to, you know, tarnish the reputation I've got here, but let's see what happens. That's always the mystique, isn't it? And the beauty of my industry, of our industry, is that you never know, do you? You never know what's around the corner. You never know what opportunity is going to be given to you next.
And from the outside looking in, it feels like those opportunities are quite high in number just because of, like, the most basic thing of the amount of TV that is being produced now. Like, it feels like, you know, with every film studio now, Netflix, Amazon, you know, there is no end of streaming services. And I think we might reach a point where something has to give, because I don't think people are going to carry on spending a tenner like six different ways every month to get every streaming service. You're going to have to go, right, which ones do I really watch? But at the moment, there's a huge desire for TV. Do you feel like the amount of potential work, not work you'd necessarily take, but the amount of work out there is like higher than it's ever been?
Oh, I think it's the highest it's ever been. I mean, I'm about to shoot a Christmas movie, believe it or not, in August for Amazon. You know what I mean? It's literally snow machines and everything. It was kind of magical when I walked out on the set. I was like, wow, it actually really works. But so you get people like Netflix and Amazon that are actually producing their own single films, as well as their, you know, epic sort of long-running series. The work, the breadth of that for actors out there is just kind of tenfold at the moment. And that's that's a great thing. The challenging thing is to find the right project that's going to punch through the ceiling, because there is so much content. I don't know about you, I get sort of overwhelmed as to what to watch. I don't quite know. You're committing a huge amount of personal time, aren't you, to watch these shows?
Yeah.
But it's great. It's great. And what I do worry about is British independent cinema going to fall by the wayside because of it? Mm. Even sort of cinema in general, do you know what I mean? I think it's weird, isn't it, in the lockdown, when you're that sort of pleasure of going to the cinema, that was taken away from us. How much people are kind of still sort of wary about actually going back to the pictures, because I think that is the purest way of watching film, you know, and I think we have to sort of embrace that still and continue to do so. But there feels like there's a shift, because what you're saying is there's like all these amazing directors that are now, you know, committing to these streaming services.
Exactly. And actors now, you know, it was slightly tongue in cheek, but it was saying that, you know, your big Hollywood stars, the dream is no longer an Oscar. It's a contract with Marvel. That is the dream.
Right, yeah.
It is interesting what's happened with cinema. I mean, you know, I guess the only potentially good way of looking at it is because, like, you've either got event movies, which, you know, these that cost $250 million and, like, you know, have to make a billion or whatever to succeed. So that's one end of the spectrum. What's disappeared is the sort of middle of the road, 60 million blockbuster, which were exciting and had money spent on them, but were an original idea. But what still exists is your very low budget films. I mean, a lot of it is horror, but there is, you know, there are still some interesting movies being made that cost so little that, you know, they can make their money back. Yeah. So I guess there's an argument, but perhaps this either ends of the spectrum system that we've got going might actually generate some original ideas that cost it so little that they can still you know, play in a cinema.
But the whole thing of a long streaming series on a Netflix or something like that is, from an acting point of view, it is incredibly enticing because you are being asked to play a character over a long stretch of time. And that's kind of every actor's dream, isn't it, really? The sort of opportunity that that gives you. You know, something like a sort of Bryan Cranston in Breaking Bad, you know, it's sort of, it's just a mammoth undertaking, isn't it? And if it's done well like that was, it's kind of, it's iconic.
Talking of movies, you've had a couple of cameos in some big movies, which I do want to mention. First of all, 1917, that must have been quite an experience stepping onto that set, if only because, you know, they made those trenches. It was a real set. It was a big deal.
It was a big deal. I mean, I if you want to do a Steadicam shot in a war film, then you've got to come to me because I've done that epic Steadicam one in Atonement with Joe Wright when they land in Dunkirk. So to be honest with you, when I stepped out on 1917 with Sam Mendes, I was like, yeah, this is par for the course. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. Where do you want me to stand? 1917 was an absolute unforgettable. I was like 3 days. I had a kind of cough and a spit in it, really. But
Start the movie.
But you're right. They literally dug that whole trench system. So just literally to be on that set, to see how the mechanics of it worked with the crew, how they were moving the camera, where it was, you know, coming off the crane and handheld, and it was just extraordinary. And then we got into that scene with Colin Firth when he gives them the mission, and the camera's still kind of coming in very slowly, and then the roof to the thing is lifted. It was just next level brilliance. Yeah, the great thing about 1917 also was that, weirdly, we shot it on Salisbury Plain where the trench system was, and you couldn't actually turn over if it was raining or if it was sunny. It had to be overcast for no shadows and for continuity. So there was quite a lot of time of us just hanging out. So
I don't imagine you had to audition for that, though. That must have been just a phone call going, would you like to play this role?
That was just a phone call. And it was, it's a great example to all young actors, this, because I'd never met Sam Mendes before. And then the phone call came through and it was Nina Gold, casting director. And she said, look, everyone's going to do a little cameo, but it's mainly about the two young kids. And like Mark Strong's doing it and Benedict Cumberbatch. And I was like, yeah, of course, Andrew Scott. And you're like, I'm in. But I do remember, even it, I had a very small role, but it was, I arrived and it, come and meet Sam. And he was, I went to his trailer and he was just the nicest fella. And he explained to me the whole inspiration for the film. We talked about the character. I felt like an important cog in the wheel. Do you know what I mean? He really made me feel at home. But he said to me, Danny, it's just great to meet you. I've seen you in that play, in this play and that. And I was just like, wow, you saw me at the Donmar. You saw me at the National. And I was just like, I never knew he was in the audience. So it was just, I always say to young actors, you just never know, you know, whatever project you're in, a play, a TV, a short film, whatever it is, you just don't know who's going to see it and something will kind of hopefully transpire from it. So, but it was great. And I mean, I have to say, the first time I ever sat down and watched that film, it was, I just think 1917 is an absolute masterpiece. I thought it was an amazing movie.
Yeah, George Mackay is wonderful in it as well. Yeah, it's an incredible film, and it's funny going back and watching Spectre, his second Bond movie, again now, and watching that opening, which is basically a rehearsal for 1917. Yeah. It's like I think I've got an idea for a movie a little bit later, but I'm not going to say that here. So it's just one long shot at the start of Spectre, but yeah, it's great.
The similarities between Atonement and 1917 was like, don't forget your lines, hit your mark. When the camera comes to you, do your thing and move on. It's quite pressurized.
Yeah.
Because if you screw up, you've got to reset the whole thing because it's obviously, it's one take. Mm. It's quite scary, yeah.
I bet. Also, it would be remiss of me not to mention Rogue One. You had a camera. You like got a little role as Tivik in Rogue One. That's
yes,
a very fun scene.
And Alex, again, that was it was just a phone call. But I was part of the reshoots. I think they did a couple of weeks reshoots, and I when The Force Awakens came out, Milo and I said, okay, because he was really getting into Star Wars, and we watched all of the films in order in preparation for The Force Awakens. And then that was fantastic. And I then get this offer out of the blue to be in Rogue One. And I was on holiday, and then I had to have a Zoom chat thing with the director. And the first thing he said is, okay, Danny, you're not allowed to tell anyone about this film. And I went, no, of course. He went, no, you're not allowed to tell anyone. You know what I mean? I was like, wow, this whole secrecy thing was like paramount. And I was like, okay. Like, and I couldn't help myself. I had to tell my son. I think he was on like a sort of thing, and he wasn't. And I said, do you want to know what Daddy's next role is? And he was like, yeah, whatever. He went, it's Star Wars. And he just went, no way. And to be fair to Milo, he was brilliant. He kept it a secret. And look, Alex, it's sort of surreal. You step out on Pinewood Lot, and there's like, you're in a scene with stormtroopers. Do you know what I mean? It was hilarious because they were just sitting around having coffee. And you're like, that's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it was an amazing set, you know, like a street scene. And it was great to be up close with all the kind of animatronics and all the props and just the scale of model making, and what they did with it was just incredible. Yeah. But I mean, I left that day thinking, I may be in it, I may not. I do you know what I mean? It was like I could have ended up on the cutting room floor. So thankfully I made it. And to be fair, it was a cracking scene. There was a lot of exposition. So in a way, it was kind of integral to the story at the beginning. And indeed, he is the first character, isn't he, to get blown away. And then it progresses all the way through the film. I have to say, I think Rogue One is, for my money, the best of those standalone movies. I love how dark it is. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. And I you sort of, knowing that it was part of the reshoots, you sort of go, well, that's interesting that they wanted to give you a better idea of Diogo Luna's character early on. The fact that, you know, he will kill to protect his, you know, identity and his mission and everything. So that is interesting.
But I remember Tony Gilroy, the director, guy, because I remember going, because I went to, I'll get killed again. He went, I said, I'll get killed in everything. I've been shot, stabbed, blown up, poisoned. And he went, hey, man, they'll do a prequel. You know, you come back. And I was like, yeah. And they are doing a prequel of Diego Luna's character. Have I had the call, Alex? Have I, fuck? and I was like, I can't believe it. I'm going to be back. Anyway, maybe the phone will ring in a couple of hours. I don't know. But it'd be great to see that series, that standalone thing as well.
Yeah. Hey, Danny, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, mate. Really lovely to chat to you this morning.
And you, Alex. Yeah. Well, hopefully I'll bump into you with the dogs someday soon.
Yeah, I'll be able to pay closer attention to our conversation this time because he's older now, so he's not doing that thing. At that point when I met you, Simon found it hilarious to specifically steal food from children's hands, which is it's just one of those conversations that you just don't expect to have ever in your life. I'm sorry, this animal that I am in ownership of has made your child cry. Can I buy it an ice cream? Yeah. One of the few times you can offer a stranger's child an ice cream and it not be weird. Can I buy your child an ice cream? Because the dog stole it. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
You got a busy day coming up, or are you?
We've got the actual press launch tonight of Code 404. I'm off out to Soho. We're going to screen the first two eps, and we're actually doing a pub quiz with all the journalists beforehand. So it's me, my team, and Anna Maxwell Martin's the captain of the other team. So I think they're just celebrating that everyone's coming out of lockdown. So that'll be fun, and we'll show the first steps and have a couple of drinks and hopefully bribed them into giving us 5-star reviews.
Let's pull back that curtain. That's what it's really about. Yeah. Oh, well, listen, good luck with it. Like I said, big fan of the first season. So really looking forward to seeing this one. And you have a lovely day, mate. Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you, Alex. All the best, mate. Great chatting with you.
Thanks, Danny.
Cheers, buddy. All the best.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.